Okay, good afternoon, everybody. So welcome to the second lecture of programming languages. So last week we've discussed various consistency models, like strict consistency and sequential consistency, and I would like to briefly recap the definition of sequential consistency. Because what we want to use these happened before diagrams for is to show that a certain system is not sequentially consistent anymore. So suppose you have just two programs, and one of the programs executes this sequence. This sequence here, and the other program executes this sequence here. And we fix that up front. So that means, so the sequence of operations is a path through the program. So this path could contain several the same statement several times. So if we think of the running example we had, the first thread just executes A equals B and B equals 1. So here we have little choice, but we have to take this path, first action, second action. So this would be P1 or P11, P10. And the second operation is P11. And the other thread was this while loop that said while B is equal to 0, do nothing, and afterwards we read A, and we want to ascertain that A is 1. So here, what we could have is, I'll use blue now for this path that I'm choosing, we could have that the while loop executes twice before it finds that A is 1. So let's assume it executes twice. So we will have P1, and then afterwards we execute this a third time, the test, and then B is 1, and then we execute the assertion. So here our actions would be P20, P21, P23, and P24. So I have now two programs, and I fixed the path through each of these programs. And because these programs communicate, this path doesn't necessarily have to be feasible, but it should be. So in this case, the path is feasible because it is possible that this loop iterates twice before it sees that that B is 1 and then executes to execute the assertion. So these two paths, which are now in blue, So now the two paths are in blue. I'm fixing these two paths, and a sequentially consistent system is one where this execution always has the same result. So afterwards, with these fixed paths, the result always has to be the same. If it isn't, my system isn't sequentially consistent. And intuitively, this means if I change the speed of execution without changing the interaction of the threads, then there should be no difference in the observable behavior. So, obviously there is this communication, and here the loop has to iterate twice. But besides that, besides this fixed interaction, the outcome should always be the same. So if suddenly A is, for instance, 0, then the sequential consistency is violated, and that's what we want to show. And we do that by starting off with a system where we just have the MESI cache, and we will add new components that make this model of the system more realistic, and then we show how this more generic model breaks this assumption and gives us a system that is not sequentially consistent anymore. Okay. go back to the slide where we stopped last time. So I showed you the different actions that the cache can do last time in this list, and then afterwards in this diagram where we had the happens before model of processor A and processor B with their own local cache holding copies of A and B, and each of the variables in a different cache line, because I have to assume that in general they are in a different cache line. And the other thing that was a bit confusing is if I'm writing A, why do I have to get the content? And we assume that A is just occupying part of the cache line. So if I really want to change A, I have to re-in the whole cache line, change the little bits that represent A, and then later write it back. This might not be realistic, but that's how we model it. Okay. So, now, here we are. We have this MISI cache protocol, and the problem with this is that here we execute the assignment, and we send a read invalidate message, and then here's a read message. And the nice thing here is that if we read B again, it's in our local cache, and we don't have to traverse the whole system to get to the value of B. So if everything would be in RAM, then we'd always have to ask the RAM every time. So it is better. However, if we write to the store, then why do we have to wait until the other processor tells us that it has So the thing is, so we're asking for the cache line because A is not occupying the whole cache line, just a little bit. And once the cache line appears in our own cache, we can override the little bits that represent A. But why should we wait for that? Because the cache can just sit there and wait for the cache line to arrive and then do the update. So why is the CPU stopping? So what we really want is that this arrow here is not there so that we can start executing the assignment to B before the whole assignment to A has actually finished. And that will allow us to do an out-of-order execution where we pipelining the execution of several instructions, and so several instructions are actually being worked upon at the same time. So I want to get rid of this error and make the processor just continue running. So that's easy enough. And the way I do this, I need a little buffer that tells me about what write operations are still in progress and not finished. So what I want, if I have a cache miss, I want to continue execution. So the idea is between the CPU and the cache, I'm adding a store buffer. It's called buffer for historic reason. So this store buffer contains a write, so it's the address that I'm writing to, and the content, and maybe the address also tells me which bytes I want to write over. So if each time I write something, I just put it into the store buffer, which automatically triggers this fetching of the cache line. And then I'm done, I can continue with my next statement. And once the cache line has actually arrived in the cache, the entry from the store buffer is taken and it is applied to the cache. So the thing is, the buffer is historic, and today a store buffer is always a queue, and that has to do with the semantics that a queue is much more restrictive. So for instance, a queue means if you write twice to the same address, then the two writes are not combined. So even the earlier one, that in principle will be overwritten eventually by the second write, will still be put into the cache, because otherwise you can have a write to A, then you write to B, and then you write to A again. And if the other process depends on some interaction, some change between A and B, or between B and A before, then this could be lost if you combine the write to the second write to A. It might overtake the write to B, and then the other processor cannot see that A is written before B anymore because A is written after B because now all both A writes to A are before B. So those are very subtle point, and I'm not going to talk too much about these things. This also has been fixed in recent editions of the Intel manual because they weren't very clear about it. The processors seem to always obey this, but then they didn't want to specify that much.
But then again, if you have two writes to the same location, and the other process would depend on them not being combined, isn't that something like depending on the execution speed?
No, because, if you have a write to A, a write to B, and then a write to A again.
Yeah.
There's nothing about speed.
No, I mean,
here, but
if some other process depends on B being written after A,
mm-hmm.
then it depends on seeing the write to B before the other processor is able to execute the write to A, which is a time constraint. Right?
Well, but I mean, it can also be time, you can always turn it into like a semantic logic, like a value constraint. So here A is always greater than B, for instance. So the other processor could just have assertion A is greater than B. And if you combine the writes, if they're in the queue, and this is oldest, T, and this is younger, T plus 1, and this is even younger, T plus 2. If you now combine the writes and then put this write down here, then suddenly A becomes bigger than B. So it's not; it has nothing to do with timing. It's about value semantics.
After executing A equals 0, the constraint is violated, right? So only
not if B is like 0 initially. So I'm just like, so B is greater or equal to A, that's the assertion in the other processor. So this is what is checked all the time. And
But after writing 2 to A, this assertion is violated.
No, because...
if you say...
Oh, sorry, it's the other way around. Yes, it's true. I think this is a bad example. There are other examples. If you really want one, I can look one up. They're in the Intel processor manual. It's about transitivity as well. So it's like about three processes. There's some examples with three cores, and they communicate via some transitive property. I don't have a good example here on the top of my head. Okay, so back to the store buffer. So what do we have to do with the store buffer? In order to just at least have sequential consistency not violated within a local CPU, as in what the CPU sees as its store, then each time we read something from the cache, we need to first consult the store buffer because if we just write to A and it's put into the store buffer, and then we read from A, and we simply ignore the store buffer and go directly to the cache, then that's wrong because in the cache A is zero still. So if we go down, if we read something, we need to consult the store buffer. So this is what's supposed to be indicated by the arrow here. If we draw some information from the cache, we need to consult the store buffer first. And if the store buffer contains a write to that same variable, we need to return that result. So, and specifically, we need to return the youngest value that is in the store buffer that's waiting to be written. Okay, and now the question is, what about the sequential consistency about the whole system? Okay, so now I'm using a new process to model the store buffer, and that process sits here. I will... So in the store buffer, I have the pending write, and the write will be executed whenever the CPU has time to do it. So initially, my cache is in the following state. A is 0 and in shared state. B is exclusive and is zero, and a cache in B, there A is also in the shared state and zero, obviously, and the B cache line is invalid. So I write to A, and so there's something in the store buffer here that says A is equal, must be set to 1 eventually. And then I write to B. So I can do this because, I can always do that. And but for B equals 1, if I set B to 1 and my cache has B exclusively in its cache, then we can immediately execute this assignment and we set the cache line to modified. Since it's exclusive, there's no other processor that has a version of this of B in its cache, so we can just write it. Okay, and then suppose that B executes the test whether B is 0, so it sends a read request because its own cache line is invalid. The cache of A replies, and it goes in, because not read invalidate, just read. It turns the cache line to shared 1, and the result is shared 1, and so the loop exits. And then afterwards we check, the next action is to test whether A is 1, so we look back to the cache. The cache is in shared, which means, we can just read the value, so it's shared 0, and the assertion is violated. And then eventually, the store buffer in the first CPU will be emptied. And so here, the value of the new value, the invalid date of A will be executed. It will arrive in the other cache and will come back, and then we can update the cache to be modified 1. And so obviously here this assertion fails. And so this is an example how we manage to break the sequential consistency, because the result with the same execution as we had before, like this path and going once the loop and then taking the assertion, the same path where the assertion held earlier is now violated because the assertion doesn't hold anymore. It has a different result. So this is an example of a system that is not sequentially consistent anymore. So what can we do to repair this? So first of all, we don't want to avoid this overtaking of writes. It is desirable because, it increases the speed of the CPU. However, these store buffers render the programs incorrect that assume sequential consistency between different CPUs. So whenever we need to communicate with shared variables, we need to do something extra to get sequential consistency back. So whenever two stores in one CPU must appear in sequence at a different CPU, we need to insert a write barrier there, which means, what does it mean? First of all, a write barrier is an assembler instruction, which, for instance, in the Intel process is called SFENCE, for store fence. A write barrier marks all the current entries in the store buffer or in the store queue. And marking just means it's setting a bit. And so the next store operation that is coming after the store fence is only executed when all the marked stores in the buffer have completed. I think this should be the next assignment. That's clearer. So the next assignment in the program is only executed. So the whole program, the processor stops until the store stops and waits until the store buffer is empty, and so that the next assignment is executed once all these writes have been executed, which guarantees that the next assignment is an assignment to a variable that is an exclusive state, we will not update this cache line until all the stores have been done that are in the store buffer. Oh yeah, certainly. Since 10 years, this is all weak memory models, and this has been around for a good question, but I think Pentium or something like that. Okay, so what can we do? Well, we can insert write barriers to repair our programs. So putting a write barrier between these two writes, basically after every write, gives back the original behavior, because every time we have a new write instruction, all the other writes will have finished. So adding a write barrier after each write will give the sequential consistent CPU behavior as we had earlier. And it will also be as slow as the behavior we had earlier. So no overtaking of stores at all, or no concurrent execution of stores at all. So we should only use write barriers when necessary. Okay. So let's see how this example looks like with a write with a barrier. So here we have two writes in one thread that need to be visible in the same sequence in the other thread. So we insert a store fence between these two writes. Okay, so the same state for the cache. In the first CPU, the A cache line is in shared zero state. The second one is exclusive zero, and B contains also shared zero for A, and the B cache line is invalid. So we do the write. We send an invalidate. The invalidate arrives. It will invalidate the buffer, and the invalidate acknowledge will come back. Now, we had this message pair at the very back, and now it's in the up front here. The reason is that the second write instruction cannot execute before this fence is completed. So this fence basically says as soon as the write buffer is empty in this case, so we mark everything that's in there, and that's everything, that's just the write to A, and then as soon as it is empty, we can continue executing the assignment to B. And the B assignment just operates on the local CPU, turning it into modified as before, and then we read B, and because it's invalid, we send a read request, and then it's shared, and here we receive B, and it's 1, and so we continue in the loop. Then we try to read A, and then we see that it is in shared. It's in invalid state, and because it's in invalid state, we need to send a read request, get the shared. Oops, sorry. So right here, we have shared 1, because once the invalidate acknowledged comes back, we can do the update, and it's modified, sorry. It's modified. Modified 1 because we're writing it. And then at the very end here, since it's modified, afterwards it is shared. And it's 1 because it's just a read, not read and validate. It's shared. And we'll wind up in shared state here. And it will be 1. And the assertion holds. Okay, so by putting in the store fence, we've repaired the program. And note, there's no way that we can put the store fence after the B, because this has no effect. There's no statements anymore. So it has to be between the two writes, which guarantees that the two writes appear in this sequence to all other CPUs in the system. Okay. Are there more questions? No. Okay. So this is all good. And our second problem is that we still want to go faster. So one problem is that these invalidation messages. So each time we want to invalidate somebody else's cache line, we need to send a message and we need to wait for all the acknowledgements. So even if this is like somehow a consensus thing that everybody who's like, you send a message out and the hardware of all the other processors guarantee that they will shout as soon as you send the message that they are not agreed, they're not acknowledging that you can invalidate the cache line. So you can avoid actively sending invalidate acknowledge messages by some sort of consensus that if everybody keeps quiet on the bus, then everybody acknowledges it. And if somebody doesn't acknowledge, then they send a message. So there's ways to make it cheaper, but still you need to wait for the acknowledged message. And you want to continue executing. So for instance, we'll see in a bit. So this example is obviously bad because then we want to wait. Okay, so in these invalidate messages, they're also problematic because if we have a high load on the memory, like in the path to the RAM where we need to like read a lot of data, then all these invalidate cache messages, they compete with the normal read and write back messages of the CPU. So the bus is very busy with messages that are not really doing any work. So if we have a cache-intensive computation and our CPU is busy sending, like our cache is full, we need to do emit write back messages, but our cache is, our bus is basically busy with all the invalidate messages, our store buffers could fill up and we could just stop executing because we have to wait until the bus is free again. So one idea is to immediately acknowledge an invalidation and then apply them later. Okay, so the idea is that we can execute many things here and we don't really need to actively invalidate cache lines in our cache. We just put all the invalidate messages in an invalidate queue and we apply them later when we have time. So each time an invalidate message arrives, we put it into the queue. And so if we have a message that will access a cache line that is also mentioned in the invalidate queue, we obviously need to process that message in the invalidate queue first, or like wait until it's processed before we can continue. But we can implement that in hardware, and it's doable because you can compare all the entries in hardware in parallel. It's not so bad. But the main difference is, like the main performance gain is that if we do a normal read and write, except that the address is checked whether it's occurring in the invalidate buffer, we do not have to actually apply consult invalidate queue for cache lines that are locally available. Okay. So more details is in the literature that I have at the end of the slides. But let's just check what the sequential consistency is if we have these invalidate buffers where the invalidate messages are just queued. Okay, so the same scenario. We have a store buffer, and now we have in the B CPU only, in principle, both CPUs have a store buffer or store queue and invalidate queue, but I'm only showing the store buffer in A and the invalidate queue in B because of lack of space and clarity. So we write A, 1 to A. So wait, the initial state is the same as usual. B is exclusive 0, and in the other cache, A is shared 0 and B is invalid. So we want to write to A, and since it's shared, we need to send an invalidate message. The other CPU puts this invalidate message into the invalidate queue. So maybe we have like now A in there and immediately sends an acknowledgement. Now, due to this store fence, the next instruction B set to 1 will not execute until the store buffer is empty. But since we've received the invalidate acknowledge message immediately, or very quickly at least, we can very quickly proceed with B setting B to 1. And since B is exclusive, also here it is modified 1. And since B is exclusive, we can set B immediately to modified 1. Okay, and now we read B. And so we send this read message to the other cache because our cache line is invalid. What we get back is the value of 1. So we put it into our cache, and it's now shared between the two processes. And then we check that whether A is 1, so we consult our cache. And our cache says that A is in shared 0 state. So the assertion fails, and that's bad. And then eventually, the invalidate message from this invalidate queue will be applied and setting A to invalid. So now we have this kind of a duality. We have store buffers and we have invalidate buffers. Adding the store buffer gave us a problem with that stores can like overtake each other from the viewpoint of view from the other CPU. And now we have the problem again that if we read from memory, then suddenly the reads could, well, in principle, well, from the point of view of a different CPU, it reads things that aren't really in a, like, it sees its own cache with in a state that is not really the global view of the system because it still has invalidate messages in its own invalidate buffer that haven't been processed. So since these read accesses do not consult the invalidate queue, we might read a value that is out of date. And so we need to, like, again, as with the store fences, we need some way to reestablish the sequential consistency between writes of the other processor and local reads. And the way to do that is to add a read barrier. So a read barrier placed before a read access from a shared variable will make sure that all invalidate messages are processed so that we know we see an up-to-date version of the value that we're reading and not something that is actually supposed to be invalid already. So in this case, a read barrier on the Intel platform is an assembler instruction called LFENCE for load fence. And what it does is very similar to the store buffer. It will take all the messages that are in the invalidate queue and mark them, set a bit in them, and then it will stall the next read until all these messages are processed. So the next operation is only executed once all these marked invalidation messages have been processed, so all these cache lines have been invalidated.
Invalidate message, and you do not want to set the bit to invalidate inside your cache.
Well, I think maybe I haven't made that clear enough. So, I think the point that I should have made is imagine a CPU that does a cache local computation, very computationally intensive, and then there's another CPU that basically creates, for whatever reasons, a lot of invalidate messages. Now, if you don't have an invalidate queue, each time an invalidate message comes along, the store buffer and the reads will compete for the cache, and the invalidate messages will compete for the cache. So if another CPU produce a lot of invalidate messages, this CPU could just grind to a halt just because it has to process all the invalidate messages. So even though the two CPUs don't communicate at all, this CPU, in order to acknowledge all these invalidate messages, is stalled.
But it has to acknowledge them immediately, right?
Well, no, it doesn't. Well, in principle, if you just say, or you get an invalidate message and you have to send an invalidate acknowledge, you can take time. And you have to be able to take time because you cannot always guarantee that you can process them instantaneously. Because if there's a write happening in the cache, then you cannot cannot process an invalidate message.
On your last slide, you only edit this arrow, this direct response to the invalidate message, just because of the fence in the other core. Because otherwise the other core would need to wait for the fence. this is why you immediately send the invalid message on your side.
What do you mean, when I only discuss store buffers? Or
yeah, on the last slide.
On the last slide?
Yeah. The core, answer immediately, you invalidate act.
Yes, because you have an invalidate buffer, so you just put it into your buffer, and you are able to implement hardware that immediately answers with an invalidate acknowledge, and so that that the local CPU is installed. And if this local CPU comes to a point where the arithmetic, where it just accesses, something in another cache, whatever, does complex local computations. Then invalidate messages can be processed. Okay. So, again, the symmetry, if I would insert a read barrier in front of every read access, then I will get sequential consistency as I had before, because every time before I'm reading, all the invalidate messages will be applied, and I'll have the same old behavior as the normal MESI cache had. But it will also be as slow as this MESI cache without these invalidate buffers. So the idea is what I need to do to get sequential consistent prog or behavior is that I match each write barrier that communicate with myself with a read barrier. So each time I have two stores that I want to see in that sequence, I have to insert a store fence between these two stores, and each time I have two reads that will kind of receive or may possibly observe these two writes, I have to put a read barrier between these two reads. So every store fence or store write barrier has to be matched with a read barrier somewhere else. Okay, so I modify my program because here I have a read from a shared variable and then I have another read from a shared variable, and I want these two reads to observe the proper order that they had in the other processors. So what I do is I insert a load fence. So let's go through this. We have A is in shared state 0. B is exclusive 0. Here it's the same, and then it's invalid. So I try to write a 1 to A, which means that I send an invalidate message which gets put into the queue, is acknowledged immediately, and I can write a 1 into my cache. Then I have a store fence that prevents me from executing the assignment to B immediately, but once and invalid acknowledgement has been received, the store buffer is empty, and then I can perform the update, which will put the cache line of B into modified 1. Now the other processor tries to read B. It's invalid, so it sends a read request. Afterwards, B is shared, and down here it's shared as well with value 1. Now I see a load fence, so I mark all the elements in the invalidate queue and wait for them to be executed. So all the elements in the invalidate queue will be applied to the cache, which means that the A cache line will be invalidated. And once that is all done, the L fence has finished, and then the next read statement can execute. So then the next read statement sees it's invalid. It will send a read request, get the result write back because it's modified, and then see that it's in shared. Well, it should be 1, not 0. 1, 1. Okay, and now we have that the assertion holds again. Are there questions? So just for clarity, last time I said, well, when, in the last year we had a confusion about when do I have a read response, when do I have a write back. So a write back happens if I have a modified cache line, because a write back is basically sent to the RAM, to memory, and the other processor just sees that and snoops it and thereby picks up the value. And a read response is just traveling from, is just propagating data that is not modified and that's globally the same, and that's just propagating this data that's known by the memory and by other CPUs to those CPUs that don't know it. And so it's not going to the RAM. Okay. So, to summarize... Oh, we're good. Yeah?
Question about the metadata and metadata technology. Why do you have to do them at all at the moment? Is this just to know that the other processors are there, or...
Well, this comes back to this MESI like the MESI protocol. The so you're asking, can I omit the invalidate acknowledgments or the invalidate messages altogether?
You can send the invalidate out, but you don't need the invalidate acknowledgment at all because it just sends it out when it gets the invalidate, so you don't have to wait for the invalidate acknowledgment.
Well, the thing is that you need to. Okay, so I discussed this arbiter last time that just like goes around and tells the CPU it's your turn if you want to send messages. Now there's something very special. I mean, this is all slightly abstract. So with invalidate messages, it's a bit special. It's because an invalidate message is sent, and the CPU waits until it gets all the acknowledgments. There's no other message being sent between an invalidate and all the acknowledgments coming back. So assuming we do what you say, we just send out invalidate messages and we don't care about acknowledgments, then the problem is that two processors could try to write a cache line at the same time, and so this one sends out an invalidate and this one sends out an invalidate. And, they would do that in sequence, but like maybe it's if you want to buffer them and you don't see them, then maybe you have two invalidates, which means that two processors could write to the same cell, and then it's not clear how the cache would recover that. If two processors have a cache line in modified state, then who's going to respond? It's not clear which value is the valid one. And that would give even more problems and make it even harder to program. So the MESI protocol says there's certain invariants, and one invariant is that a modified cache line can only be in one core at this for one address. Okay. Good question. Okay, so I'll summarize. So this weakly ordered memory models, they have been around for like a decade and more. And the idea is that we speed up the execution of the processor, especially this out-of-order execution, where we have several instructions that are being executed at the same time. So one is being fetched, one is being decoded, one is being executed, and then you generate read requests and write requests, and so you have these this pipelining of method of instructions. And unless you have a jump, if you have a pipeline depth of 6, you can execute 6 instructions at the same time, where each instruction is at a different stage in its execution. And so with this pipeline model, these read and writes to memory are not in sync with the execution of the individual statements anymore due to the store buffers, where a cache line that is not, an address that is not in the cache is put into the store buffer. An address that is in the cache might be written to directly, which means that if some other processor requests a cache line, it might get access to the value in the cache, or even if the local processor, that's sequential processor. So if the other processor asks for a value, it might like get the value from the cache, but not in the store buffer, and so one written value might overtake the other one. And a similar argument holds for the invalidate buffer. So the read and writes are synchronized within each CPU by looking at store buffers and invalidate buffers. By store buffers, not invalidate buffers. But from the point of view of the other CPU, read and writes might change order, or two writes and two reads might change order. Okay, so this was just like very basic, because there's many kinds of memory barriers. There's also you have the same problems with code cache, because with code you have like you could generate code on the fly and then jump to it, and the question is, do you have to have a fence between jumping, like generating the code and jumping there, because maybe the CPU holds, so the Intel CPU, as you might know, this instruction set is very awkward, and it converts the instructions into simpler instructions called MuOps, and they're stored in a small cache. And so if I write something to memory and then jump to it, then maybe the CPU has this line of bytes already interpreted as instructions, is in the local MuOp cache, and then if I just write to this address and jump immediately to it, maybe it's still having the old outdated values in its MuOp cache. So the same problems exist at the code generation level. And there's other very subtle differences on various architectures, and people, hardware engineers have like experimented a lot there. So most systems at least provide one barrier that is both a read and a write fence. So for instance, Intel originally only had one instruction called an mFence when they didn't have the invalidate buffers. And that nowadays does a store and a read and write fence combined. So, and what about usages? So this is, obviously you're probably not going to write a lot of assembler in your life, because there's better languages to do most of your work. So if you have a normally compiled language, so not just in time, but ahead of time language that compiles to assembler and that's executed, yes?
If a CPU gets an mFence command, what does it do?
Oh, it does a read fence and a write fence. So it will invalidate. It will wait until the store buffer is empty and the invalidate buffer is empty.
Okay.
So this is like the sledgehammer, the biggest one that does everything. Okay. So the question is, what happens if you write normal code and it gets turned into assembler, and then you might have optimizations that move instructions around, and so one way, if you then insert special calls to functions that just simply execute in a store fence or a read fence, then the compiler might just move instructions before this function call and after the function call, because it doesn't know that this store fence will actually affect the semantics of your program. So one old-fashioned way to prevent that is to make all those to declare all your variables that with which you communicate with other CPUs, to declare them as volatile in C and C++, because that tells the compiler, each time I'm reading this variable, I really want you to read it from memory, and I don't want you to move any stores or reads across this read, because traditionally it's been assumed that a volatile variable actually is some sort of hardware component, which is some sort of you're not reading from memory, you're reading some sort of port that where there's some signals from the outside on that port. And so each time you read it, you want to actually access it because it's changed from the outside and it's not programmatically changed. So the compiler should always assume that a volatile a variable always changes.
So C compilers will actually also add an mFence?
No. No, you still have to explicitly call a function that emits the assembler instruction mFence. But you also need to declare your, like in this example, the A variable and the B variable as volatile, otherwise the compiler might just reorder them and first set B to 1 and A to 1, because without the fence and without the knowledge that it's actually communicating to a different processor, the two assignments can be swapped around without an effect on the values. Yes, for instance. So if you keep A and B in registers, you might first read A, read B, modify the registers in the right sequence, and you write back first B, then A, which effectively looks like if you've stored first B and then A. Yeah. Okay, so, and obviously people have addressed that in later revisions. So if you now declare a variable volatile, they will automatically insert a memory barrier, if it's a store barrier, if it's after this access, if it's a store, and a read barrier before this access, if it's a read. And otherwise, you have to use inline assembler. And there's even, like in the newest C++ standard, there's even an atomic keyword, especially for this purpose, because volatile also means you cannot keep it things in registers and and so atomic is a bit less aggressive. Okay, so in summary, these memory barriers obviously are a very low level way of synchronizing, and probably not advisable in everyday's life of a programmer. But sometimes if you want to implement fancy algorithm and you really need to squeeze performance out of some communicating processes, then there might still be necessary for you to use. Okay. So now I'm going to give an example of an algorithm that basically does use shared variables to communicate. And it's called the Decker algorithm, which is a communicating, it implements a critical section for two processes. And the idea is that we have an array of flags, and the array has length 2, so it's 2 flags. And they indicate whether, flag I indicates whether the process I wants to get access to the critical section. And then we have a variable which is called turn that says who is allowed to go and to enter the critical section. So if the sequence of actions is that when nobody wants to enter, both flags are 0. If somebody wants to enter, if process I wants to enter, flag I goes to 1, is set to 1. And then if turn is 1, it can enter. If turn is 0, it has to be set to 1 by somebody. And so if the turn is I, then, and flag I is true, then that process will enter the critical section. So I will explain the code on the next slide. So here I just want you to see that basically the code is identical except for the numbers. So here, everywhere where I have 0 here, I have 1 here, and vice versa. So in principle, I could just write this code once and use I and 1 minus I, and depending on how I'm setting I, I get this code or that code. Okay, so let's see what it does. So it's totally symmetric except for the swapping of the zeros and ones. Okay, so I just look at one of these. So as I said, flag I is true if the process PI wants to enter its critical section. Doesn't mean it's in the critical section. And turn I means that process PI has the priority to enter when both threads want to enter. So if there's a contention on the critical section and both want to enter, turn says who's got to go. So if I am in process I, and I want to enter the critical section, then I first set my flag, so assuming I'm 0, I'm setting flag 0 to true, saying I want to enter the critical section. Now, if the other process also wants to enter the critical section, I do the following if statement. Otherwise, I am in the critical section. And at the end of the critical section, I set turn to 1 to give the other process priority. And I set my flag to false because I don't want to be in the critical section anymore. Okay, so this flag I can be looked at as a lock. And I'm acquiring the lock by setting it to true. Okay, so assuming that I want to enter the critical section. And if the other process also wants to enter the critical section, then we're competing for the critical section. Then we have to do a little bit more. So I check whose turn it is. And if the turn is not mine, so if it's not zero, then I'm resetting my flag back to false, and I'm waiting for turn to be one. And now, as I said earlier, down here what happens is I'm simply setting turn to the other process, so I'm giving the other process priority as soon as I'm done with my critical section, and I'm setting my flag to false. So in reflection, what I see from the other process that is currently wanting to enter the critical section, and actually if turn is not zero, then means turn is one and the other process is in the critical section. So if this is true and this is one, then the other process is in the critical section. In this case, I'm saying I don't want to be in the critical section. It's okay, you go. You set turn and you wait until the other process has set turn to zero. So here we just wait. Once the other process here has set turn to one, turn to zero, so that would be turn equals zero here, then I can exit this loop. I can again say, oh, I now want to enter the critical section, and then I go back and check whether the other process also wants to enter the critical section. And presumably, because the other process set flag of one is false, because like once it leaves the critical section, now I'm seeing that flag of one is false, and I can actually enter the critical section myself.
So the critical section is inside the while loop.
No, the critical section is. So this is. I'm sorry that there could be parentheses, but for lack of space, there are none. So the critical section comes after the while loop. So only if I manage to leave the outer while loop, I'm in the critical section. Well, yes, so setting the flag to one means you call lock, which might block you.
Okay.
So it's the act of wanting to enter, it's not having the critical section. And it doesn't say that on the slide, so if I said that, it's wrong. So it's flag, so I am in the critical section if my flag is one and if turn is one, if turn is I, is my identifier. Okay. Is everybody happy with this algorithm? Roughly happy. I mean, maybe just like think about it for another 5 minutes at home. And so in the exercises, you will implement this algorithm and see how it breaks horribly on current processes, which is all the fun. Oh, there's more. So that's the end here. So, no, that's here. While waiting for a turn. Okay, so I've explained that already. One caveat is that the algorithm only works for two processes, and the generalization I think is called is the bakery algorithm by Dijkstra. That's much more complicated. So what kind of properties do we have with Dekker's algorithm? So it has three very nice properties. The first of all, obviously, is what we want. It ensures mutual exclusion between these two processes. So the critical section will only be executed by one of the two processes. And moreover, it's deadlock-free, so one process will not wait forever if the other process eventually exits its critical section. And it's also free of starvation, so if both processes want to enter and always want to enter, it cannot be. Like, so if they're really busy entering the critical section, it cannot be that one process always gets to go and the other will wait forever, because the turn will always change from 0 to 1 and from 1 to 0. If both want to enter, it will alternate between the two processes. So it's fair, which is a very nice property and not necessarily very common. Okay, so what can we do with Dekker? For instance, if you think of Google, everything at Google is MapReduce. So if we do a reduce, it just means you take a state where you could accumulate something. So for instance, if you want to compute the sum of a sequence of numbers that you're getting. You initialize your sum with zero, like you accumulate with zero, and then you pick up the first value, you add it to your accumulator, and then you take the second value and you add it to your accumulator. So this is a reduce. You just basically you take a sequence of data that comes in, and you're doing something to that each element and your current state. And your current state changes while you do that. And the other one, a map, is an operation that, if you know functional programming, reduce is called fold, but map is also called map. So if you have a sequence of data, you turn it into a new sequence of data values by applying an operation that has no state to each value, and you obtain a new one. So for instance, if you have a sequence of integers, you could add one to each integer. So it's the function increment applied to all the elements in this sequence. Okay, so there an abstract way of writing this using MetaC. So it's nearly C++. I have some sort of initial value, and that's my accumulator for the reduce operation, and my reduce operation itself is called F. So I'm doing a loop, and for the number of elements I'm getting, I will give the index to F, and the accumulator F will access the ith index, ith value, do something with this ith value and the accumulator, and will give me a new accumulator. So this is like here I'm returning a tuple, which C can't do either, but I just wanted to keep it structurally simple. And I will also... this is actually very general, as a more generic. So it's not only a reduction, I'm also emitting a new value for each element that I'm looking at. I call this temp. And then this... that doesn't make sense, does it? If it should be there, I should change it in the future. So this is not really a reduce. I'd get out a new value, and then I apply a function g to the new value. And the function g will take the index. And it will do something to temp and store this value at index I. Okay, so I'm reading index I, do something with the accumulator and this element. This element is the output that was put to G, and G will then do something to temp and then write it at index I in the output. So I have an input array and an output array.
So you actually do first to map and then you...
No, actually I do first reduce, because I accumulate something and this is just the temporary value. I mean, I could have just said... Okay, let's make this clearer. So I have an input array in... and I have an output array out, and I index this with I. Okay? So I could say F accesses in at the position I. What I could have done is I could have created an intermediate stream called temp of I. Okay, let's first say what G does. G takes a value, computes something from this index, and creates a new value that it puts into the output sequence. So what I could have done is I could have created a temporary intermediate sequence so that F writes to temp, it reads from the ith element of in, it writes to the ith element of temp, and then G reads the ith element of temp and writes its result to the ith element of out. So this is F, and F also has this accumulator, which is passed through, and then this part here is G, and G doesn't have an accumulator.
But one of these is map and the other one is
I think this, well, G is definitely a map, and F is some sort of like...
Because they look both like map.
Yeah, they're both... I think F is actually not really a reduce. It used to be fold, and fold is also wrong. In Haskell, it's called scan. Basically, it's like you have an accumulator and you output a value. That's why I should change this. So it's not really reduce. Reduce would just give you one value. Okay, anyway, it's still a common operation. It's just not called reduce. So I apologize. Okay, so the gist is these are two functions. One does accumulate, and one just transforms a sequence of data elements. And these operations are kind of like happening in sequence. First F is applied and then G is applied. And the problem is that if I try to compute F, I need the accumulator from the previous iteration. So I cannot just simply compute F and then G and that in parallel on all elements, because F needs to be executed in sequence. So this whole program is non-trivial to parallelize. I cannot just like say for all index indices I just spawn a process to do first F and G, because the ith iteration of that computes F needs the accumulator from the previous iteration I minus one. So how can we parallelize this? Any ideas? How would a good optimizing compiler parallelize it? So
it seems that the computations are mostly independent, so you could probably create some hundreds of threads and compute in each individual thread only one part.
Well, the thing is, they're not like if I say F reads accumulator and returns a new accumulator, then they are dependent. So it's not necessary. It's not trivial. So if it's addition you're doing and you're actually calculating a sum, you can partition it because addition is associative. But say this is what could it be? It could be some other operation where you need to adhere to the proper sequence. No. So the idea was, if I have the accumulator initialized to zero and I'm actually trying to compute the sum, then I will have 7, and then 6 plus 7 is 13, and then I'll have 18, and then I have 19. So each time I apply F, it needs the value of the previous accumulator to get the new accumulator, to compute the new accumulator. Well, no, yeah, that, if addition is associative, if this operation is much more complex and you cannot just simply, so you say, why don't I do this? Yeah, but like this works for addition, but it doesn't work for other operations. So imagine this is an MPEG movie encoder. You will take frame after frame, and obviously this is not associative. You need the frames after each other. Yes, exactly. So the first encodes, the second adjusts the lightning or something. Okay, so the idea is, as you said, to use two threads. One does F and one does G. And so the F thread will, each time it has computed one new element, it will pass it to the G thread.
Could we even have multiple threads for G?
You could, and that makes sense if G is really slow. But it's very difficult to have multiple threads for F because it needs the previous result. Yeah. So, but to keep it simple, I needed an example where you can use Decker. So, we initialize the accumulator as before, and then the idea is that we just have some sort of buffer that allows us that F is running a little bit faster or slower than G. So we can store at least a few elements as an intermediate result. So what we'll do is we have the process PF that will compute, take the accumulator, compute the new element, and put this temporary variable value, the result of the ith iteration, into the buffer. And in the other thread, I will read the buffer and get the next element out, if there is one. Otherwise, I'll block or busy wait. And then I apply G, and G will write it to wherever. And so on this buffer, I could implement with Decker by implementing put and get with one of these critical section algorithms. And if F and G are similarly expensive, then we're very lucky, and this parallel version might run twice as fast as the single-threaded version. If we use Decker, obviously it's low level. It doesn't involve the operating system, but that means we cannot do something sensible if we actually have to wait for the other thread. We will busy wait. Maybe we can like find something else to do and do it instead, which would be great. But potentially we'd have to just busy wait. But on the other hand, if we just have a lot of cores lying around, there's no harm done. And maybe we could even just say halt until something interesting happens. Those instructions exist, so we don't have to waste all the energy. And since we have a buffer here, we could just... increase it so that F can actually generate more and more elements up to a certain limit. But obviously, if G is very slow, this is difficult. On the other hand, if G... All right, so let's assume I have just one element in the buffer. I think these two lines just... assume the buffer is just, has just one element, which is a bit sad, but... So if you have multiple elements in the buffer, then obviously there's some leeway. So, and if at all possible, maybe there's something G and F have to do that don't necessarily involve the frame, but some computation has to be done, and then you can do that while you instead of busy waiting. So who knows? It might just be the Decker protocol might just be the ideal algorithm for this. So in general, if G also manipulates the states, it just becomes like F, and then this is kind of this the concept of stream processing that is very common in data intensive applications. So these reductions and maps, or well, in Haskell it's called scan L and scan R, but I don't know what it's called in general. So something where you map and you accumulate something at the same time. Well, reduce is like, as far as I know, reduce is just like taking a lot of data, like yeah. But so basically, I think F is a map and a reduce in parallel at the same time, because you're like producing an element for each input element, and you also compute something accumulatively. That's why reduce doesn't really fit. But on the other hand, this is this enhanced reduce that like does both output an element for each input element and accumulates is very typical in signal processing or image processing. If you encode a video, you always get a new frame, and you have your current state, which is the history that you had from your encoding the last frame. Because like a video encoder will always look at the difference between two frames and only try to encode the difference. So for that, you need the previous frame. And this is very typical that data is manipulated in several stages, or if it is typical, then you can split it into several threads, each implementing one of these stages. And as soon as one item has passed the stage, it can be communicated to the next stage. And so here you could use this Decker's algorithm to pass the information between the different states. The fairness is a bit superfluous here in this algorithm, but why is that? Well, because if the producer doesn't really need to get access to the buffer if the buffer is full, and on the other hand, if the buffer is empty, the consumer doesn't really need to get access to the buffer. But still, it is important that there's no starvation if you cannot exclude the situation that the producer will try to acquire the mutually exclusive section just to find out that the buffer is full and exit. So if you cannot avoid this altogether, you need fairness. Otherwise, the producer might always be in the critical section, realizing that the buffer is full, and the consumer will never get a chance to empty, like take one element out. And maybe that's a specialization of the algorithm. I'll leave that as homework. No, not really. Okay, so let's go back to the real problem. So Dekker's algorithm requires sequential consistency, because it is very important that I first set my flag to 1 and then set first read the other process's flag and then read the turn variable and so on. So all we need to do abstractly is to make it thread safe after principle. So we don't want to like write all possible interleavings in complex happen before diagrams. We just take the principle, like we just say define one principle to fix the program and then do it. And the principle is as follows. Well, this is what I've said earlier, basically. I insert read barrier, read memory barrier, L-fence, in front of every read from common variables. So remember, the read barrier ensures that the invalidate queue is emptied and so that I get to see an up-to-date version of the cache, of my local cache. So whenever I read, which is here, for instance, I insert an L-fence. And this is actually valid C. The comma operator just means first execute this statement and this statement, or this expression and then this expression, and return the value of this expression. So I can just like hack it in and put the L-fence function call in here. And here I'm reading again, so I need to put insert an L-fence. And here, the second principle was, that's all the L-fences. The second principle is that I need to insert a write memory barrier S-fence after writing a variable that might be read in the other thread. So basically after all the variable writes in Dekker's protocol. So remember, it's the store buffer. All the stores are in this queue in the store buffer. And if I do an S-fence, I will wait until the store buffer is empty, which means that all the other processors will see this state before I execute a new store, which might be reordered with all the elements in the store buffer. So the store buffer is empty, so nothing can be reordered. So I need to insert an S-fence after writing a variable. So where do I write a variable? Up here I write a variable, so I insert an S-fence. Here I'm writing a variable, so I'm inserting an S-fence. And here I'm writing a variable, so an S-fence. Afterwards, we set turn to 1, an S-fence. And then we set flag to 0, and we insert an S-fence. And now you see that this M-fence instruction, that is a load and a store fence, could be used here to like use one assembler instruction less, for instance. So here is a load fence immediately at the beginning of the while loop. And maybe, just maybe, somehow, I could combine that with a store fence at the end. So here's a store fence, and here's a store fence, and it's always, after executing one of these store fences, I'm having an L fence afterwards. So what I can do is I can get rid of this, I can get rid of this, and I can put an M fence here. Okay, so this is a little optimization, probably not, well, with little gain, but just conceptually, because M fence is S fence plus L fence, you could do that. So, this doesn't mean this is the minimum number of fences. It could be due to the processor properties or whatever, or maybe there's some other things that happen after this statement here, that this S-fence, for instance, isn't necessary. And maybe there's some read after, like two writes in a row, where the sequence in which they appear in the other thread aren't really necessary. But I haven't actually looked at this in detail. You'd have to check all the interactions in the two processors. This will work. But I invite you to experiment and remove some fences and see whether it breaks. No, because assuming that this is costly, and especially what you do outside the critical section is very computationally intensive, then these few fences of these few instructions over these three variables that are just therefore communicating between processes is very, very small. So the benefit of having store buffers and validate buffers pay off here, and here, and here, you basically disable them.
Yeah.
So you get the proper semantics for interprocessor communication and the speed when you don't care about what the other processor sees. Okay, so memory barriers, they're certainly the lowest level of synchronization primitives that you could possibly have in concurrent or parallel programming. So why are they useful? Well, if we have some sort of, or when are they useful? So you probably heard about locks and maybe monitors, and I'll discuss that next week. But whenever you have two processes that kind of are in a, implement some sort of finite automaton, so they go from one state to the other, and they somehow need to communicate that to the other processor because they can only do a transition here if the processor here is in a certain other transition. So basically there's no real waiting. They just like do transitions depending on what the state of other processes is. Then memory barriers are the real way to just ensure that you can read the state of the other processor in a safe way. Dekker's protocol, in principle, is a finite automaton, but you just use it to ensure mutual exclusion. And there might be other applications where you have finite automata, like processes that simulate finite automata, without actually just ensuring mutual exclusion. And so the synchronization could just be coordinating the transitions of several automata. And on the other hand, maybe sometimes you have some you don't care about energy because your cores don't have anything else to do. Maybe you can put them to sleep, but you don't care that anything else runs, and then this is cheaper than just going to the operating system and get your threads descheduled and rescheduled. And inside operating system implementations, obviously you don't have locks because you don't have an operating system. You are the operating system, so you have to use memory barriers. And There's even a very interesting thread where they discuss an algorithm and Linus Torvalds says, no, there has to be a fence in there, and then somebody from Intel comes in and says, no, actually there doesn't have to be a fence in there because our processors don't do that. And so it's like they really care about memory fences. And if you look at the Linux kernel, they define some primitives and they have to use it. So if you ever write a driver, you might have to use fences. Why might they not be so appropriate? Well, difficult to get right, especially for some very specific, maybe even proven algorithms like Dekker's protocol. And often locks are much easier to use, and they can be as fast, locks. If you have too many fences, maybe Dekker can be made faster, because if you have too many fences, it could be costly. And then the question is, if you really have to work with barriers, then how do you communicate? How do you tell your compiler? So there's this volatile keyword that just avoids all optimizations, which might not be so good. And there's this atomic keyword in C++ 11, and that will automatically insert memory barriers each time you read or write to it. Java, Go, well, because it's a high-level concepts of communication there, like monitors, the runtime has to actually do the work. Summary, what we did is strict consistency, sequential consistency, weak consistency, where we have to recover strict consistency using read and write fences or barriers. We've illustrated the consistencies by using the happened before relation and the according diagrams. And then I showed you that if you enhance the MESI protocol with store buffers and invalidate buffers, you need to use memory barriers to get sequential consistency back. And I've shown you an example of Dekker's protocol that needs memory barriers. And I've shown you an application of Dekker's protocol to do some sort of stream processing. And I've shown you how to make it sequentially consistent by inserting fences. And now in the last 5 minutes, I will tell you what will happen next, as in the future. So this is already reality, of course. If you do HPC or something, they have these systems, and it's called NUMA. And currently it's called SMP for symmetric multiprocessing, which means there's several cores, and they have a common memory, and they have a bus. So I'll make a little picture because I like pictures. CPU 0, and then I have another CPU, N, and then I have a bus, and I have memory. Okay. So does anybody know how fast electricity propagates? So, so electrons actually travel quite slowly. But electricity in the right medium goes at the speed of light, which seems quite fast, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. That seems... No? 300,000... It's kilometers. It's 300 and then six more zeros. Yeah, so I have a little cheat sheet. Now, if I say my motherboard is like 30 centimeters in diameter, because I have tons of little cores, then if I say how long does it take from the signal to travel from here to there, so 30 centimeters is 0.3 meters. What I can do is I can divide this speed of light by S, and I get, I'm very naive here, 0.000 milliseconds, microseconds, nanoseconds. So this is 1 nanosecond. And if you remember, like if you read something about speeds of processes, they talk about picoseconds. That's so three digits less. So frequency, just like, I mean, this doesn't tell us much. At least if you're not an electronics engineer, 1 nanosecond probably doesn't tell you much. So let's take the reciprocal again. So 1 divided by 1 nanosecond is 1 divided by this. And this is a 1 with 1, 2, and per second, which means this is 1 gigahertz. So even if your motherboard is only 20 centimeters across, then this is 1.5 gigahertz. That means if you generate data with 1.5 gigahertz at one end of your motherboard, and it travels at the speed of light, by the time you send it, it will be, like if you send the second bit, the first bit just has arrived. So maybe that's an indication why front side buses are just stuck at 1.3 gigahertz or something. Like it takes a lot of time at these high frequencies for the signal to travel. So if you have CPUs, a CPU that sends an invalidate message here, and this CPU has to send an acknowledge back, that means you're limited to sending no more than 500 million messages a second. So there's a hard physical limitation as to how many messages you can send across. Okay. And then there's one observation. And the problem is that this is a bus, and the bus everybody listens to, and everybody, so there's an arbiter which says, oh, you can go. But everybody has to listen to the bus. And if you just can send, you can like send, and the other person could send on a different wire back. And then you don't have to look at the bus. You just send data, but your protocol becomes more complex because you have to send and you have to wait for an acknowledge. So it's a big message passing system, and it's not this shared medium anymore. Okay, and this is the idea of NUMA, where you just have point-to-point links where you send stuff. And you don't just listen to the global ether on the, like to the bus. So the idea is we partition the main memory amongst the CPUs. We have a lot of memory, so every CPU gets its own memory. And then we need a directory, which is a bit like a name service in the internet world, which tells you which CPU owns a piece of data, like a cache line. So what happens is that you have processes. Each process has main memory, and then you have I/O. And you can have a point-to-point connection, like one to send, one to receive, between each pair of processes and maybe even the I/O. So NUMA systems could be partially connected, so some links are missing. That makes communication even harder because you just like have to figure out how to get there. It's like the internet, really. You have the directory, which is also not local, so maybe every if you divide the addresses by 4 and the remainder is 1, then you know this processor contains the directory for that cache line. So if you have a cache miss in CPU A, which is here, then what it will do, it will send a retrieve request to CPU B, which owns the directory that contains the information where this cache line actually is. Now CPU B knows that CPU C owns the cache line. So CPU B will send a message to CPU C to send the data back to A. So this is what CPU A will do. CPU C will do. Then CPU C will send an acknowledge message back to B that it has done the request, and then B will tell A that here you are, you actually have received the cache line that you've asked for, and it's the one that C sent you. So this is a NUMA system, and you can see that it's complicated, and I don't want to draw happen-before diagrams for these things. Thank you very much. Next, this is the literature. I recommend this one, and next time we'll talk about locks.